The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Centre Parks. Families that go here, grow here.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last week, all in one place. And so to this week, on Monday's show, our favourite Dancing with the Stars judge, Arthur Grunlian, joined us. Jennifer Bray, political correspondent with the Irish Times, detailed the abuse and unacceptable behaviour that mostly female public representatives are met with. Janine Edgeworth on the unfinished business of childhood bereavement and how writing her book, The Thing About Feathers, helped her. Brian McManus is a YouTube content creator with almost 4 million subscribers on his Real Engineering channel. And on Friday's show, the screenwriter who brought us Sully and Elf, Todd Komarnicki, on his German spy film that just finished shooting in Ireland. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy. At 9:25, the great Arthur Grunlian. I mean, do we all
It's okay.
Dancing with the Stars judge. One thing I noticed from you talking last night about it was that you danced with the dancers on this song.
I spent 4 years with Girls Aloud.
Yeah.
And I know this song like I'm obsessed with this song.
When you hear that, do you go, oh, I heard it so many times, I hate it. Or do you go, oh, I remember that.
I remember, I'm loving it because it brings back so many memories. Like I think I said last night to Brooke, I said, you just brought back so many memories to the song. There's always something, you know, you're always connected to a song in life. So that's always going to be Girls Aloud in my heart, yeah.
Okay, let's pause and pray to the corporate gods.
Dancing with the Stars on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Muller Corner. Mullerlicious.
And now we are allowed to speak about Dancing with the Stars, which of course...
We're back.
Woof. We have been redeemed. And Dancing with the Stars last night was... I think it's a great old season this year already. Like, we're week two, but it's buzzing.
Absolutely agree with you. Do you know what? The past 2 weeks has been incredible. Mm. I said since beginning, this year, compared to my first season, this year, everybody has a rhythm. And in dancing, you have to have a rhythm. You can teach someone steps, but if you don't have a rhythm, it's kind of difficult. But it's been absolutely incredible.
I don't know if I agree with you.
Yeah, come on.
No, but I just
Ryan,
think...
come on.
Because I'm somebody who cannot dance. Yeah. Which I'm the opposite of what you are. You're a capable, competent, and talented dancer. I'm everything
that
isn't.
Thank you.
Now, and yet, as a punter on the couch, I'm not sure everyone can dance.
Okay, I'm going to rephrase this. They have a rhythm, but not everybody can dance.
All right,
rhythm and dancing is two different things.
Right.
So you have a rhythm to keep up with the music, but not for that you can dance.
You gave, even you.
Oh, don't. I know where you're going
even
with this.
Even you,
don't.
Johnny Kindpants, turned around last night. And your voice dipped several octaves as you sadly pronounced a four or a three. We won't mention the people just yet, but we'll get there.
Yeah.
How does it feel to deliver such
horrible
bad news?
Oh. Feels horrible. Horrible. Do you know what? Because like you said, you know, they are non-dancers and they're working so hard. Week after week, they try to bring the best out of them. And me watching it, and I have to do my job because I was thinking, I was like, if I go higher, I will hate myself later on because I won't live with myself. But then at the same time, when I was picking up that paddle, horrible feeling.
Right? Okay, let's go through what happened to whom. And obviously, it all kicked off with with Brooke and Maurizio, and that was the song they did.
That
Girls
was a love machine. I said, she's a dance machine. Not a love machine.
She's
dance
good, isn't
machine.
She?
She's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a pop star. People were saying, oh, she's a pop star, she can dance. I was like, no, I work with lots of pop stars who got two left feet, but she's a pop star who can incredibly dance.
Yeah, so there's no great surprise there. 2 8s and a 7. So we'll move on to Damon McGinty and Kylie Vincent, who also did quite well. They did dance Jason Derulo.
Jason, I love that song, Acapulco.
Acapulco, yeah. Of course.
But again, same, you think, like people saying, oh my God, Glee star, you know, in Glee, you think, dance, you know, perform, act. But he got the moves. I just told him he needed to relax a little bit.
He needed
to work on his freestyle a little bit.
Yeah, they got 2 7s and a 6.
He did very well.
Not bad. The relaxed thing keeps coming up with
I know,
some
because
of them.
People think they have to be very tense to go stronger. No, you can relax. It's fine. You can be soft.
The former state pathologist, Mary Cassidy. Oh, I'm starting to get used to it. Last week, my head was blown by the fact that she was there. Last night, it was okay. It was Ole Guapa
Stanley Black and his orchestra was the tune. She got a 5, a 6 and a 5. Your thoughts?
My thought, she was not bad, but her feet were kind of messy. Her face was on point with a tango face, but her feet were kind of messy. But you know what? She's trying so hard and I love her. Yeah. She's so cute. I love her.
Now, tango face doesn't refer to fake tan, does it?
Not at all. Just I refer to that. Tango face is like intense, you know, looking into somebody's eyes.
Or tango dancing.
Tango
face.
Dancing. I love
we
it.
We need to establish the facts here.
Exactly,
we move
just to
on.
Make sure.
Thank yeah. you, Arthur. And we move on to Kevin McGarhan and Laura Nolan. They repeat. I was there,
yeah.
the Overtones version.
The Jive.
Wish they had used Jackie Wilson's, by the way. I'll just say the original version of that
okay,
song. But
so
we'll
you know
on.
That,
yeah,
thank
yeah,
you. I knew from Overtones, but yeah,
but okay.
thanks for that.
I mean, they're great and all, but...
Yeah.
Anyway, 2, 3 sevens, the Jive, yeah.
Again, good. I was saying earlier, actually, as a comedian, I thought he was going to come, have fun, give 50% and go home. But he's actually giving 150% and he's taking very seriously. And I'm really proud of him. It okay. really shows that he's going really hard for it.
He's
yeah.
doing well. Now,
very well.
Now we move on to the slightly difficult, thorny subject of Miss Stephanie Roach.
Miss Bonavore.
A lovely person who looks the part, no doubt about it. She's dancing with her Venus.
Stunning.
And she got 5 from Lorraine. That's top points.
Yeah.
4 from Brian. And then the voice Don't. Went. The voice went low as you barely whispered, 4.
Oh my God.
Why?
I'm dying inside. I'll tell you why. I think Stephanie got potential, but she just had to get out of her comfort zone. She's too soft. She needs to act even more. She needs to be animated. You know, in dancing, it's not just dance steps. It's acting. Dancing, it's acting. And I don't see that from her. Even the steps were too soft.
Okay.
She wasn't giving me anything.
Now, how much does Arvinas, can Arvinas do, her dancer? Or is it just he can only do the best with
he
what
can he only
has.
Do the best. He can push. But I think that needs to come from Stephanie.
Okay.
She needs to go. Like, you know, she's an amazing football player. So the way she kicks the ball, just kick the dance floor.
All right, okay.
That's how you should act, actually.
She'd bring that
Get
in.
Get stronger, exactly.
Oh, that was tough. I thought the point scores
Oh, my God. Like,
but you needed to be honest to yourself, I think.
I had to.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
what? I went back home and I was like, if I went higher, I would have not really... like myself, no.
But the story gets worse for a Derry girl, Leah O'Rourke, who's dancing with John Nolan. And Lorraine gave her 3. Brian gave her 3. Again, your voice went down to the... you plummeted the depths of the Atlantic Ocean to say 4.
Ryan, it's a horrible feeling when you're sitting there. You don't know what to do. You're like, I want to support you, but at the same time, it wasn't there. It wasn't there. I mean, her face was good. She smiled. The top part was great. But the bottom part was walking in the park, really.
What does she need to do? She has a lot of work to do with these points.
She's got a lot of work to do. I mean, she did the 3 lift, which was very ambitious, which was great. But she needs to be a little bit softer. But she needs to work harder. She needs to go. I feel like it was a rehearsal I was watching.
Okay, the next 2 dances caught my attention. Very compelling performances coming down the tracks. The Byrne Bros, Shane and Karen. Now, Shane Byrne, I tell you, he's my surprise hit.
I
find
him
very watchable.
Yeah.
Very charming.
But you know what? It's not gimmicky. It's not gimmicky. He actually does the steps.
He can bounce.
He can bounce. He can dance. He can move. He never missed a beat. It's just there wasn't cha-cha-cha much of
but
them.
But the
like
scores are rotten. 4, 5, 3. Is that because like I'm watching it going, I really enjoyed that, but you're looking at it going, that was terrible dancing.
Yeah, there wasn't hardly, like Lorraine said, there was hardly any cha-cha-cha in it.
Do you know what I mean?
It's just like fun. You just roll your hands. Hey,
okay.
It was just like a fun dance. It wasn't your typical what you want to see.
Sounds like the end of an Irish wedding.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like that.
To choirs of them. Yes, exactly.
You're not
exactly.
That
I no, but I loved it. It's entertaining. Don't forget, this show is entertainment. We need that too.
No, but you're not rewarding entertainment.
I know, but I can't reward entertainment. I'm rewarding the dance. Oh,
okay.
My God.
So maybe that's where the Irish public come in when they start
Correct.
Voting. And they start voting for people they like as opposed to dances that are professional.
You absolutely nailed it. Yeah. This week, it's all about the Irish public. You have to vote for your favourite. That's it.
That's it.
We can give our scores, but you have to actually save your favourite.
So this day next week, sitting across from me will be whoever gets kicked out, which is the first person who will be kicked out. And we won't... even go
don't at all.
Okay, the next stand was another head-turning performance from Paul Brogan and Salome. I mean, yeah.
I mean, just that beginning, the way it started, I was like, is this even human? The way Salome started that, it was just hot. I can't even talk.
I know.
It was steamy.
It was like, as Chili's go.
Yeah,
it
was... I'm actually sweating. Is it hot in the room here? No, it was, again, it's huge entertainment and he's so sweet. You know, he's this big lad with big muscles, but he's so sweet, so nice, but he needs to relax again. He's too stiff. He needs to relax. Oh my God.
We'll just let that slide. He got a 5, a 4. And a 4. Not great. Again, no. My question there was Salome doing all the dancing.
You know what? You see, you're not a professional, but you've seen it. Exactly. Salome was very clever. The way it was choreographed. She's amazing. And my eyes were going to Salome, which is wrong. I should be looking at Paul, which was I was also doing it. But Salome was doing the most of the work.
Okay.
And she's amazing at how she creates everything.
All right. But fascinating. Now, Panty also getting a lot of attention and... Did Aretha Franklin, You Made Me Feel Like a Natural Woman.
Stunning.
And I'm actually enjoying Panty's back and forth with the judges.
I mean, she's a drag queen.
Very funny.
If she wasn't actually doing back and forth, it won't be drag queen.
She's a sass queen, as we
she
said.
She is, exactly. Exactly.
She got a 6, a 7, a 6. Not the best numbers.
Not the best, but she was really good. Do you know what? Again, there was a few things missing, but as a slow dance for a drag queen, it's unusual. Yeah. And I love that she stripped everything back, the gimmick, you know, of a drag queen, and she gave us a beautiful performance. It was very elegant.
Yeah, I admire that. It's not very, very. It's not enough just to have the drag thing if you got to move with it.
Exactly.
Which is
just
what's
simple,
happening.
But beautiful.
So Sumi, Suzanne Jackson doing very well indeed.
Like I mentioned last night, the one to watch, because I remember last year I said to Nina Carby, you're a dark horse. And she was kind of, I'm going to rephrase myself, she's a dark horse because she's quiet, she's beautiful, but then she works so hard. But also I said to her, you're very perfectionist.
Yeah.
Sometimes that could be good or bad because you put too much pressure on yourself, which is just relax.
So tread carefully.
Exactly. I want you to enjoy the ride. I want you to enjoy the momentum what we're having here.
Okay, 9. You give her 9.
Oh, I mean,
and she got 2 8. So she's not going anywhere today or tomorrow.
No.
And I have to say, I thought he was great last night, Carl Mullen, with Emily Barker. Carl, who started off as, could have been the comic turn after week one, but somebody somewhere, probably himself, said, no, I've got to fix this.
Yeah.
Don't be a joker. Yeah. I think get rid of the goofy suit and get busy.
And he absolutely smashed it. He was actually the biggest surprise any show I've seen from week one. Normally this happened in week four, but it was the best one from week one to week two. Yeah. I mean, he absolutely smashed it.
2 8s and a 7 to you two's beautiful day.
Beautiful day.
Like that. And a great result. All right, Arthur, that's good enough for us. Thank you for being here today.
You're absolutely welcome.
You shattered some people's dreams last
night. Oh my God.
So you've got to live with that for the week.
Oh my God. I will redeem myself this week.
Next week. It's really good to see you. And thanks for coming in. We'll do it again soon, I'm sure.
Thank you very much.
And best of luck for the rest of it. It's 23 minutes to 10. Just hitting 9:30 now this Tuesday morning, and I'm joined by Irish Times journalist Jennifer Bray. Jennifer, good to see you. Thanks for coming in to see us this morning. And the reason I wanted to talk to you today was because of your piece on Saturday. Will you tell people at home, please, what you wrote and why?
The idea for this piece was spurred on after the incident at the public meeting in Gort, where there were 2 bags of cow dung flung towards Fianna Fáil politician Anne Rabbitt and the Fine Gael politician Ciarán Cannon. And immediately afterwards, there was this debate about politician safety and about their, you know, their general safety, both online and in person. And this advice went out to TDs this day last week or Monday last week, which basically told them, you know, you can wear more comfortable shoes or maybe perhaps you can angle yourself differently when you visit people's doors. And I noticed talking to TDs, female TDs in particular, that they were outraged at this advice. They were kind of saying, you know, what's the point of this? This isn't good enough, given what we're actually facing. And what I really noticed was, on foot of that advice, male TDs saying to me, oh, it's not that bad. You know, it's okay. We get it here and there and now and then, but we still do our constituency clinics. You know, we still go out and about, etc.
And what was the nature of, why were they being advised to wear sensible shoes or what have you?
In case they needed to make a quick getaway. Effectively, if they needed to run away.
So the we're talking about abuse, physical sometimes, verbal sometimes, online nearly always. And this advice, what triggered that advice to be issued in the first instance?
I think it was, it had been issued before, and I think it was this time on foot of what had happened in Gort and kind of politicians
saying,
you know.
Okay, because of that, they said be careful, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so this advice went out, and I did notice, like I said, the divide between male TDs and female TDs. Mm. So I kind of thought that was interesting, and I kind of went to a lot of the female TDs and said, listen, you know, why don't you tell me the extent of it? Tell me how bad it actually is off the record, because they didn't want to talk about it on the record. And a large number of TDs came back to us. Around seven TDs I interviewed kind of fully. Around five of those kind of gave me copies of emails, voice notes, messages on Instagram, messages on Twitter, emails between them and Facebook, conversations with them and the Gardaí. And this is how the piece kind of was, that's where it came out of effectively. And I have to say, I knew it was bad for female TDs because, you know, you'd hear stuff working as a political correspondent, just chatting to people really. But the extent of it, I genuinely was shocked. And at one point, sick to my stomach.
What made you sick to your stomach, for example?
I mean, there was this one letter that was sent to a female TD. She's very well known. She's tough, you know. And the letter basically was a really detailed description of explicit sexual acts that the author wanted to do to her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it started by, I follow your politics, you have a nice little body, and then the rest of it is
just vile.
Vile.
Yeah, and
vile, like. And
not psychotic, but sort of certainly menacing in the extreme, by the sounds of it.
Extremely menacing. And this same female TD then told me that at one point, you know, she, you know, they're all anonymous, so I can't say, you know, where they live or a constituency or anything like that, or what the parties they're in. But she lives in an area where there's not too many other people around, and that could be anybody realistically in the outside of Dublin. And she was getting messages from somebody just kind of harassing her. And then one day she got a message saying, God, you look even better in real life. And it kind of spooked her. And she was in her home. She said she, you know, used to be in a position where she wouldn't have locks on her doors. She would be very, you know, always felt safe in her community effectively. And then she found out that this person was camping in a field nearby, watching her through the windows. And she... It terrified her. It scared her for her life. He turned up at the door then. She told him to get off the property. And then he turned up again with flowers, apologising. But realistically, he just wanted to turn up on her door again.
Yeah.
And, you know,
that's
this...
a different level, isn't it?
It's a different level.
Online is one thing. You talk about somebody else who was saying that, you know, I have your poster up in my bedroom or something. What is that one?
Saying I have a picture of you up on my wall, and I'm not going to say the details, but it was defiled, put it that way.
I think we all know what that means. Let's
we
face
do,
it.
Yeah.
Because at this point of the morning, we have to say we're all adults here. And
true.
I think that if we sanitize this stuff, no one really wins necessarily, because we need to kind of get inside the minds of both the perpetrator and the victim here.
Absolutely.
So this person would have a picture of a female TD close by, and it's defiled by him
masturbating onto it.
Well, that's exactly what he's doing.
Yeah.
And he tells her this, and he tells her other things.
Yeah. And you know, this, I wish I could say that was just one of the examples, and yes, it was one of the worst, but this was common. And I was really shocked when one female TD said to me, oh, the usual, that's the usual. And the reasons why they gave for not talking on the record, I thought were really interesting. So firstly, they were worried that if they talked on the record, it would bring more of it upon themselves when they felt they're at breaking point. Secondly, they were really worried. People always say politicians have to have a thick skin, and that they basically, you know, you're not cut out for it. You know, you can't handle the heat. Get out of the kitchen. Which, funnily enough, after my article went out, someone actually said online. So there you go.
Said to about politicians.
In response to,
yeah,
to
of course
the article.
Yeah.
And there was that reason. So there was a couple of different reasons. They were afraid that their colleagues would be like, oh, you know, is it really that bad? And
this is all exculpatory stuff to say, you know, don't worry about it. If you're not able for it, it's actually victim blaming. It's not what they're shaming almost. It's not the guy who with the poster. It's not the guy in the camping in the field. It's actually you for not having a neck hard enough.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're called a politician. You've got some neck. And you've got, what do
you
want?
I know, you can't win. Exactly. And then you say, we want more women in politics. And then women go into politics and they get subject to this. And that was the third reason they gave, which kind of chilled me at one point, because one of the women I talked to said, I publicly say, I want to see more women in politics. But privately, I'm telling you, she said to me, you would want to be out of your mind to go into politics.
That's so depressing.
And this particular TD, I mean, you really would see her everywhere and you'd think nothing would get her down. And I was shocked to hear her say that.
Why would she? I heard the word dehumanise, you write about it.
Yeah, she said you're just completely and utterly dehumanised. And that's part of the problem, is the dehumanisation of politicians. And I'm not here to defend politicians, you know, I'm not their, you know, guardian angel or anything like this. I'm actually just
On
the contrary, you know, I'm a right pain in the side for them.
Day to day.
Yeah, so it's just, but at the same time, like when you hear these things, especially as a female, you know, working in politics and political journalism, I know how hard it is for female journalists and I know how hard it is for female politicians.
One of the people you spoke, TDs you spoke to, said, I've been called bitch, tramp, whore and idiot online and in person. I've had my photos superimposed to images of witches, people getting sick, scantily clad bodies. Is that the exception or is that common? I mean, how do we...
That is across the board, every single person I talk to. I mean, that's to them, that is the absolute usual. They open their phone, they check their messages. It's Instagram, it's Twitter. It's in their email inbox.
And they sent you these dispatches.
Yeah, and actually they didn't even need to send them to me. If you go online and look at their responses underneath on Twitter, they're actually there for everybody to see.
So people are doing this in plain sight. I mean, I was talking to somebody yesterday in the public eye who, and I said to them, you know, I'm kind of reluctant to talk to this person. I said, you know, next time we talk on air about trolling, because everyone's troll now. If you're ahead of both, it's getting boring. And in some ways it's in, and I mean that not disrespectful to what we're talking about, but I just mean in terms of giving credit and oxygen to these people who are doing these awful things. But he made the point, this person said, that it's quite shocking. I've seen it myself, that the picture of the person doing the abusing isn't always anonymous. People say keyboard warriors and they're hiding behind. They're not. They could be pictured with their family, you know, with their sons and their daughters.
Yeah, some of them in their bio would have, you know, God-fearing Christian, and you're kind of saying, really?
Or be kind.
Yes.
You know, it is extraordinary. Let's talk about another one. I've had, this is another TD you spoke to, said, I've had red sauce, eggs and other objects thrown at one of my constituency offices. My staff have been shouted at, spat at, called all kinds of names. They've had hate speech uttered in their presence. They've dealt with drunks entering my office, abusing them. People high on drugs who get very aggressive. I've had to introduce a buddy system in the offices and reduce my hours of access. So in other words, you can't go solo to a constituency office now because you don't know who's going to show up.
Exactly. And one of the women I talked to had been advised by Gardaí not to hold constituency clinics at all anymore. And the word she said she was told was, unless you're supervised. She kind of laughed and said, supervised.
That sounds like Gilead now.
Yeah, I have to. Yes. And it's just depressing. But the issue with constituency clinics now, I think, is coming up. There are talks between the government and the Oireachtas to see if maybe more funding could be provided. But see, then you go down the road of more funding for TD safety. And then there is a natural backlash from people saying, oh, politicians want more money for themselves. But I think if people understood, and maybe the article, you know, might have laid some of it bare, the extent of it, I think the question is, if we start accepting this as the norm,
yes,
and generalising it, that is truly terrifying. And what it means long term is less women in politics.
Okay, we've a number of places to go with this, because one is, let's go back to the TDs who are getting this and are trying to keep a brave face in it, get on with the job, encouraging women to get into politics while at the same time telling you privately, but it's madness if they do, because it's so awful and dehumanising. The hate speech that's shoved at them and the horrible things. How much recourse is there to justice, to reporting, or is it the greatest waste of time?
Such an interesting question, because obviously I think some people would have read it and said, why didn't they all go to the guards? And they did. They all went to the guards.
Every single day.
Yeah, they went to the guards, and they praised the work of the Gardaí, because beforehand I was wondering about this advice that had been given. I presumed some of it had come from Gardaí, but they all praised the work of the Gardaí and said they'd been excellent. The problem is, you know, getting that complaint down the line, and also the nature of some of it. I mean, if someone turns up at your door with flowers, you know that's extremely intimidating. What recourse do you have in law to say, you know, I suppose it's harassment, you know, and then there's the issue of online safety. Facebook, for example, one TD I spoke to had this 9-year campaign of basically someone online who just consistently makes up lies about her. And they're crazy things, you know, like I heard this person, this TD was kicked out of a hotel for doing drugs. Completely untrue. Mm. But they just decided to put it on Facebook. That catches. And she had gone to Facebook and said, here are, and she sent me the emails, you know, here are 10 links to different posts that were put up. And the email she got back from Facebook basically said, this does not violate our community standards. Basically, as a public representative, you are held to a different barometer. You are held to a different standard, in our view. Mm. And while I agree that
to an extent,
because you've been elected by the people.
Yes.
You're answerable to the people. So it's a public-facing role. But there has to be a line between being, I suppose, more accessible in that way and being able to combat things that are completely and utterly false.
I'm laughing, Jennifer, at the use of Facebook's use of the word community. Do they know what the dictionary definition of that word is?
I know.
Because really it's been taken and used in an abstract, cold, dismissive form, you know, usage in the form of words that they've put to that particular TD who has amassed all this evidence, obviously.
She's exceptionally angry.
Yeah, well, do you, so that brings us into another fork in the road then in terms of where to go. But you could talk about, you know, and we've been, it's kind of blue in the face saying this about the likes of Twitter and TikTok, Facebook and all of these places. Responsibility and editorial responsibility. We'll alight on that for a moment or two because it's worth saying here, who's in charge? I mean, this is the Wild West bit. There's no sheriff.
No.
And that's the difficulty. Mm. So you have all these yahoos running around the place, threatening good citizens or people who are trying to be lawmakers. And you'd hope you'd hear the clip-clop of the sheriff coming into town. No.
No.
I don't think anyone's in charge. It's like a free class.
Yeah, and look, there's all kinds of mad stuff happening with Twitter now at the moment, and you don't know what's going to be happening one day to the next. But generally speaking, I think it is the Wild West.
It is. But even legislation, I noticed in the UK, they're running to catch up because it's moving so fast as a story online. And you might pass a law, and law moves so slowly, and legislation moves so slow. This thing's moving so fast. It's like the tortoise and the hare. Now, that ended well, but I don't know if the analogy applies because it's obviously a different reality.
I think we need a different analogy.
I think we do.
But we have, you know, there is legislation going through to set up an online media safety regulator, but that's been in the works for so long. Now, in fairness, it is, you know, chugging along in the Oireachtas.
Not good enough to chug along.
But also there's, you know, there's even a debate about that because then it's, you know, individual complaints. Can I individually make a complaint to this new regulator? They'd need 10,000 staff was the argument put forward. And they still haven't squared that circle. And I think one of the other things, just to go back to kind of their experiences was, I thought it was interesting, female TDs, younger female TDs who happen to be single, they get the absolute worst of it. When it became, one TD, two TDs actually told me, separately, one of them said when it became known that she was single in her area, the number of messages she got started flooding in and she explained to me what they're like. So it'd be people saying, hey, you are so gorgeous. I think you're beautiful and I love your politics. And then she wouldn't respond. And then it would be like, hi, did you get my message? And then she wouldn't respond. And it would be like, you're an absolute
fill in gap here.
And I just, the weirdest thing was I wrote that in the story. Then I got a message the other day on Twitter from someone saying, hi, Jennifer, you are the beauty, the most beautiful of all the beauties. I mean, come on now. And I didn't respond. It was like, hello. I was like, you just...
Oh, God. Yeah.
I have to laugh at it.
It's deranged.
Except I don't.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's another world. But let's talk a little bit about civil discourse. It's something that's been kind of on my mind since the middle of the pandemic, really, when I saw the wheels coming off conversations and people were just shouting and not discussing things, just kind of angry monologues rather than civilized dialogue. Mm-hmm. That seems to be an issue here. I mean, if you take it, protests recently that you might see in marches and so on, the language being used, I saw it starting with the anti-vax stuff and then it just started going a bit, you know, as I say, off the rails. Have you noticed that? I mean, does that feed into this story, this narrative?
Yeah, absolutely. I think really realistically, I mean, the financial crash changed politics.
You think we should go back there to see that?
It shifted kind of the tectonic plates of politics, but also how we talk to politicians, how we think about politicians, how we speak about them to personally to each other and in public. And there was a lot of anger, rightfully so, you know, at politicians, completely understandable. I'm not going to defend them for a second, you know, for that. I think, but what happened afterwards was this normalization of saying such and such person is blah. If I had my hands on them, I'd wring their neck, all this kind of stuff. It grows from there. And then I think realistically, the biggest game changer has been social media, the proliferation of a 24-hour news cycle. And the fact that once you see other people online saying you're this, that and the other, then you're like, well, I think that too.
You're enabled.
You're enabled and it's normalised. And the problem realistically is the further down that road you get, where does it end? And I didn't even know whether I was to say this here because some of the female TDs asked me not to, but it's the reality of what they're really worried about is that we're going to end up in a situation where someone is seriously hurt, a female TD or a male TD, you know, they get it too, but that's the fear. And they didn't even want me to say it in the article because they were worried that I would be putting that idea into somebody's head.
I mean, they can look across to the UK of where you saw
Joe Cox
murdered, going about her business in broad daylight. God help us. And here's hoping that will never come to that.
Absolutely.
The last thing I want to mention to you, referencing your excellent article, is... and the reason I think it really got under my skin and why I wanted to talk to you today and invite you in was I despaired for the next generation of young women who might have been considering a political career. You know, I mentioned to you as we were about to go on air that, you know, I come from a political family and I've got cousins and daughters and so on who might have felt the vocation, if you like, for politics. But after reading your article and... you know, and as a political, let's face it, anorak myself, I'd be going, well, I mean, be careful. It's not my call by any means. Thankfully, it's theirs. They're smart women and that's their future. They're theirs to decide upon. What do you think?
I think I totally understand where these the female TDs I talk to are coming from. I don't blame them for one second. And I got messages from politicians after the article came out saying, from other politicians saying, I feel that way too.
Okay.
But what I would say is absolutely go into politics.
Yeah, I agree.
The more women you've in politics, the better it will get. And what we need to do is not say, oh, don't go into politics, which I totally understand why people would feel that way. But we need to say, what can we do to fix this? Mm-hmm. What can we do to address it? We need to talk about how we talk about politicians. We need to look at online safety. And perhaps there should be a Garda liaison officer specifically for.
So get in it to fight it.
Get in it. Don't just say, OK, they win. Don't let them win.
Yeah, I agree. I heard a quote, text from Ursula in Limerick by a journalist recently saying, our politicians are public servants, not public property. And that says it all. We need serious legislation for these personal attacks and abuse, and advice regarding flat shoes and comfortable clothing doesn't cut it. Anna says, I read Jennifer's article and my thoughts are, what way is society going? Do we have to legislate for respect and good behaviour? What can the rest of the female population do to support the female politicians and try to change our society? We leave that question out there. But for now, Jennifer Bray, thanks. I don't know if enjoyed that conversation is the right word, but certainly I feel more enlightened again today. And anyone who hasn't read your article, head to the Irish Times to find it and read it, because it truly was enlightening and intriguing and hopefully salutary, and something like good might come from it.
Thanks
good to see you again.
On.
Thank you very much indeed. It's 10 to 10. Live in studio this morning, Janine Edgeworth. Good morning, Janine. Nice to meet you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, thanks for sending us your book. So I think it takes some guts to self-publish a book. Not an easy thing to do, but you've got a great old yarn. So let's talk a little bit about you and tell us where you're from and how you and your family and what's happening in your life.
Yeah, well, I've got three children and I live in Coolock. I'm originally from Drimnagh and then Tallaght, so I've been everywhere.
Yeah, okay.
And then I started writing years ago. I've always written books. Children's books and adults' books, and then when you're like that, when you're self-published, it's hard to get yourself out there, and you're sending books in and you're hoping someone's having a good day or it clicks with someone, you know, that they will kind of believe in you. Then I just thought, you know, I'll have to do it myself. So I put the book out there, and to say I was nervous is an understatement, but
well,
I did
tell me about your kids. How old are the kids and what are their names? These are all the important questions in life.
Well, Daisy's 5. I hope I can remember them now.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? When you're sitting here going, what?
Leighton's 12 and Liam is 14.
You see, wasn't that hard?
That
you got
wasn't
them,
that
you got
bad,
them all
yeah.
out there. Okay, and when you were little, I want to talk a bit about you when you're little, because when somebody writes a lot, especially for kids' books, and then eventually you got your own book out, generally a lot of it comes from when you were very small and being interested in reading and writing. So did that happen from a young age
yes,
for you?
Yes, I've always loved books like The Famous Five, Enid Blyton, Babysitter's Club, all of them. I've always read books.
Yeah.
I never thought writing was something I could do. I just didn't think you could be a writer. I didn't think you could. I just thought you were kind of born, you know, a singer, or you're born a, it doesn't happen to normal people. So then I started tinkering away. I always enjoyed it in school, and my teacher was a huge support, my English teacher. She was fantastic.
Name her.
Irene Donegan.
Yeah, everyone needs a Miss Donegan. Mrs. Donegan in their lives. Yeah. And, you know, that teacher was...
She really, really kind of pushed me and encouraged me. And I got a big bullet bus one day for one of the stories. I couldn't believe it. I was too nervous to read out, so my friend Louise had to do it for me. But it really encouraged me. Yeah. And I thought, oh, maybe I'm okay, you know. And, you know, being Irish, you're like, oh, God, am I okay? So it just kind of grew from there. And then I got really serious about it maybe 10 years ago.
Isn't it amazing, Janine, that you can have the effect of a bula bus, as you call it. I haven't heard that for 100 years. But for,
it's only Irish, I know.
A suspiog as well in there somewhere. But that encouragement from a teacher.
It was huge.
You know, it can guide you in a totally different direction to the one you might have been going in.
Yeah.
You know? Talk to me about your mum, will you?
So my mum, Helen, she passed away a week after my 7th birthday. She had cervical cancer. I thought it was leg cancer till I was like 20. I'm not even messing with
you. We'll go back to that. We'll come back to that.
It was all very taboo then.
You were very little.
Very little.
Yeah. How old was your mum?
She was 40.
Oh, God, help her. Okay.
Yeah. So it was, I mean, back then it was, bereavement was different then, and grief for children was different. It wasn't something like there was probably counselling services, but I didn't avail of any. It was kind of just more get up and get on with it. Not in a cruel way, but just in, it was the way my dad knew, you know, and he was obviously grieving. I had a fantastic childhood, so it worked in a way.
You know, talking to Brian Cox, the actor on Friday Night on TV, he's 80 years old. He still remembers the day his father died and how he was plonked in front of the TV, he was saying. And that probably makes him to this day still watch TV. He associates it with that day to this day. You look at the Prince Harry story and how he was told his mother's dead. He was kind of given a pat on the back and told, you know, almost them's the breaks. You know, it was a very different. And you've just described yourself. I mean, you probably didn't go to. Did you go to your mum's funeral? I don't know if
No.
Did you go to school soon after she died?
I think I went that day, actually. I think I was speaking to my auntie yesterday and she was saying, yeah, like, we just brought you off to school, and someone on the yard said, how's Helen? And my auntie just said, yeah, no, she's grand. Because I didn't know. And my auntie was so traumatised that, you know, you just kind of, you got on with it. And I went to school. I'm almost certain it was on the same day. It was just what was done, and they just wanted you to be okay. And it's just...
Yeah. I mean, there's no badness. They didn't send you to school saying, you must go to school, even if you're upset. They're saying...
I was a little wrecked. I had to probably get rid of her for today. No, it was more so just what they felt was right back then. There is no right or wrong when it comes to grief, childhood bereavement. No one knows what the right route is.
That's
but
right.
Back then it really was, you just get up and you just get on with it.
Yeah, what do you remember of your mum? Because you were so young. Do you have any flashes of memory?
That's exactly what it is, Ryan. It's just flashes.
Yeah.
It's little flashes of moments with her, say, in the Phoenix Park, or flashes. Anyone that's lost someone, you nearly look at photographs and you're trying to nearly kind of bring them to life as you're staying. You're like, do I remember that moment, or was that just a photograph? I remembered her voice. She'd quite a kind of husky voice and a laugh, and my aunt has the exact same voice and laugh. I do remember that.
Are you becoming your mother, do you think? We often become our parents.
Yeah, like, people would say they'd see similarities. And I mean, she was funny and she was kind, and, you know, she was a good person. I don't think I could ever aspire to be that good.
What about books, words, education, and humour?
She loved reading. She's a huge reader. She also wrote, but more as a hobby, and reading was really her thing. She really enjoyed books.
Okay, so that can just permeate in, if it's in the house, you know, tends to follow through. I'm looking at this wonderful photograph here of, that's you and your mum.
Yeah.
You look like you might be about 2 or 3, or maybe 2.5 or something like that.
Yeah.
Now, this does not bode well, because you're reading a book that's upside down.
That's the image of me, upside down.
It's a book about the alpha. But I can see there's a lovely mother and daughter moment here.
That photograph was just, it's one of my most treasured possessions now. I actually only got it a few years ago, and... I think my aunt gave it to me, but I was like, wow, it really...
You didn't know it existed before.
Didn't know it existed.
And again, like you say, somebody can reach into a drawer and pull a photograph that's been gathering dust and say, and give you something really... That was a very precious picture, that.
I was tempted to superimpose a better book to it than the ABC upside down, you know, something a bit more poignant, but it is as it is. Yeah, it's a gorgeous photograph, and I really... I love looking at it. It makes me happy when I look at it, whereas for a long time, looking at pictures of my mum would have... kind of made me feel sad.
Yeah, of course.
This one makes me feel happy.
Yeah, that's a lovely thing to have. And when you when you're trying to navigate grief at that age, 8, 9, 10, 11, what do you do? Because it can manifest itself in so many different ways. It could be a headache or a knot in your tummy, or, you know, it could be a breakout in terms of personality or temperament. How did you, do you think, respond physiologically or to that?
I think it was more physical when I was younger. It was tummy pains, trips to the doctor, things like that straight after. Kind of in the year after, it was more physical things, you know, and then my dad would obviously panic and bring me to doctor with any little kind of thing I was saying.
Let's hold the horses here for a sec, because I think stomach pains, that is almost a form of heartache. You know, when you're cramped and you're just because you're in pain,
yeah.
Your body is in pain, especially when you're young and you can't explain it. And you can go to 10,000 doctors and they'll say, you're just hurting, essentially.
Exactly.
So what did the doctor say to you when you went with your stomach pain?
I can't remember the exact conversations of what it was, but I just remember it was the trips to the doctor soon after. It was tummy pains, which still I would, if I'm ever kind of, we all get a bit anxious now and again, and it would be my, you know, you'd feel your tummy.
Yeah, knocking your stomach.
But it was more physical things. And then it kind of went into a fear of something happening to my dad, which is when I was writing my book, I realised that that's a huge thing I never realised.
Tell me about that.
I was just terrified something would happen to him.
Okay.
You know, now he's at home with the flu today, and I told him, take two paracetamol, your grand. So I've obviously gotten over that. But it's like, a big day with Ryan, Dad, your grand.
I apologise to your dad, by the way, for dragging you away. I
don't even think he can listen. God love him.
God,
I'll have to play it back later.
Go on.
So it was just a profound... He was a chef, and he worked, you know, back then he'd done the night jobs.
Crazy hours.
And I would be like terrified, lying in bed, terrified something would happen to him.
Yeah.
You know, and then my dad remarried and I had a stepmom, and I had a great childhood. You know, they were both very supportive and it was a lovely upbringing, which worked as a good band-aid. But like grief, it bites you.
It does.
And it hits you when you don't expect it.
And it follows you around like a bad smell sometimes.
It really does. It's a gift that keeps on giving. It comes at you. Yeah.
Do you have anything of your mum's that you can look at and keep?
Do you know what? That was always things. We mightn't have had much talk over the years, but I always had things. So I remember my dad and my stepmom, I did, you know, were conscious to give me so I had like my mum's ring and I had a jewellery box and stuff like that. And only now I'm realising I got quite obsessed with them. So I'd be afraid not to wear the ring. The photograph had to be beside the bed. It was like that was my connection to her, even though I couldn't speak about it too much. It was more the things. And I remember actually with bereavement and when you lose someone young, in my experience, it's people pointing stuff out to you that you didn't even realise. So someone would say to me, I remember my aunt saying to me, you might not always need to wear your mum's ring. And I was like, what? And I get what she means now because I don't have it on me today.
Yeah.
It's like as if when the more you're healing, the less the things are such a...
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. And so you're not almost obsessing.
Obsessing, yeah.
You can replace obsession with, mistake it for emotional attachment.
Yes,
whereas
definitely.
Actually, there's something. Is my dad going to die? Is the ring going to get lost? You know, all these things. Whereas actually, you have to, don't you? Just
and you never connected it. Like I never talked to myself. It sounds, I feel silly saying it now,
but it's the
truth. I didn't think, I'm really fearful over my dad because of my mum. It didn't even link.
Yeah.
Or obsessing over my mum's jewellery and stuff. The ring, it didn't link to me.
You seem very grounded now. Like you're almost laughing at it. I get the sense you've got a great sense of humour.
Yeah, well,
who do you read? Who do you like to read?
I love Roddy Doyle.
There
I love Marion Keyes.
Yes,
I love them all.
Yes.
Cecilia Hearn and then obviously Claire Keegan. I would read anything really.
Do you know what? Just while we're here, I read Claire Keegan's book last week.
Oh, it's,
Whew, I mean, it doesn't take a long time to read because it's short, but it's... Yeah. It's very powerful little piece of literature, isn't it?
I've read and reread Foster. I don't know how many times.
I haven't read that yet.
Oh,
that's on Colleen Kuhn, isn't it? That's what's based.
It's unbelievable.
Is it really?
You know, I always go back to books. I kind of get a bit upset. I've got an obsession with books now, where I reread. I keep rereading.
What do you love? Who do you? I mean, what would you be your?
Paula Spencer, Roddy Doyle. I absolutely loved that. I loved Eleanor Oliphant, it's completely fine. And Foster, Craziest Chocolate was a book I picked up randomly one day. Catherine Hyde, fantastic book about a woman whose mum committed suicide and she's approaching the age her mum was.
What's that called?
Crazy as Chocolate.
Crazy as Chocolate.
The title doesn't
that.
Do it justice.
No, but it sounds like an intriguing
it's
book.
It's fantastic. I've read and reread it. So I always come back to books.
Yeah. Books are great friends, aren't they?
Oh, they really
and
are.
They give you no grief, no fighting with them and no answering back. And you don't have to, you know, text them or email them. You just pick
you
them up and enjoy enjoy the words. Are you a library person or a bookshop
love
person?
Love the library.
Yeah,
I really love the library. There's something when you go into a library, it's just, it's a real comfort. I was actually only in there yesterday, the day before. But yeah, it's...
Where's your local library?
Coolock Library.
And is it a good library?
Yeah, it's
I mean, they're all great libraries, but
yeah, they actually renovated it. It's really nice, yeah. And the kids love it. Well, my youngest Daisy loves going into the library.
Again, that's great. So you're passing the gift on to the next generation.
And my middle son is all Harry Potter, you know. He's
great.
He loves Harry Potter. And the oldest guy is actually, he dips in and out of reading as well.
Well, as they get older, you can lose them to books for a little while. But once they've got it at a young age, they'll come back, boomerang
that's
back
it, yeah.
at another point. You decided to write the thing about feathers, which is, it's your third adult fiction book, but you're very hard on yourself about your previous writing.
Did it show brutal, Ryan, let's be honest.
Brutal.
Brutal.
You should put that as a quote on the back of both of them.
Yeah.
Brutal, says me, the author.
Yeah.
But anyway, what is it about the thing about feathers that you believe is the game changer for you?
It's a book that I'm writing through my own experience, but I'm not the character Sammy. I wanted to write a book on grief in a relatable way and humorous, and the awkwardness around it, especially in Ireland, and the taboo around grief and death, and we don't like to talk about it. And even like my character Sammy, I found it fascinating how all in this day and age, it's all about manifesting and living the life of your dreams, and you create your life. She was doing all this and her husband dropped dead. I found it fascinating how you kind of get over the loss of control.
But I manifested
the life
together
forever. I didn't manifest them to drop dead, you know. So that's how I found that fascinating.
Maybe somebody else did who didn't like him.
Yeah.
Anyway, but...
It was that kind of side of it, you know, kind of being lighthearted around it. But then just how she navigated grief and... I just wanted it to be relatable. I wanted it to be something that someone can enjoy and entertain as well. I mean, life is serious enough. It is a humorous book as well.
And that's great. I mean, a comedy about death has to be, you know, something that it's also kind of deliciously dark and can be.
It definitely helps when you have a laugh.
There's no doubt. I think there's two conversations that happen around death. There's one where it's the real solemn, you know, with the family, and I'm sorry, it's in the back of the church, and then there's the other, which is, you know, at the backstage chat going, I'm going to get there late. I'm going to get in the back, shake the love, get out of there.
Yeah.
I couldn't bear going to the... I think I'll hit the removal. It's quicker. You know, and you have all these conversations that are kind of comical in a dark fashion, but that's what you're tapping into there.
And people are usually waiting for, is it the eulogy? You know, like when people are... when it's someone going up to talk about the person, that's usually... You know, there's always usually a bit of a laugh in there or a story, you know,
right.
And it connects everyone together.
You wrote it during lockdown, which we won't talk about because it gives me
the
heebie-jeebies.
Before lockdown, it took me about 4 or 5 years. I'm a very slow writer.
No, that's okay.
There's
no
grammar.
There are no rules in writing, I think.
I self-published it. I thought, you know what, I'm just going to do it now or never. So I did it, and then I would wake up every morning for a week after going, did I actually just put that out? Oh my God, I'm scarlet. It's got great feedback, and I'm happy with that.
It takes huge courage to do what you did.
Yeah.
So well done. I'm really happy for you. I noticed that you called the book is called The Thing About Feathers, but your husband can't get his head around that.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah.
Tell me.
The Thing About Fellas, he thought it was called.
Why did he think that?
Why would you take... It's actually got a bit of confusion. You know, someone else thought it was a thing about fathers. I thought, my poor dad, now imagine writing a book on him.
They're all projecting their worries of their own life on you know?
And then the kids, like my son, with The Thing About... Is your next book going to be The Thing About Tables? Like, they just thought it was
just ridiculous. You're getting great support at home, aren't
you? Oh, do you know what? It's tough skin, Ryan.
You need it.
The title kind of caused a bit of confusion. The Thing About Fellas. I was like, how does that even make sense to you?
But it's not a bad title for a book at some point. The Thing About Fellas.
I'm going to copyright that now.
I think
you should. Think about it.
You should. But the Irish Writers' Centre were of use to.
They were fantastic. And Inkwell and Vanessa Fox O'Loughlin, all of them have supported me over the years. I've gone to courses. And as everyone says, you have to write.
Yeah.
You know, writing every day. And I find Irish authors are a great support. When you're even interviews, like I would look up to Sinead Moriarty and Sheila Flanagan, anyone you write, Katy Kelly, you know, they're so supportive.
I've interviewed everyone you've mentioned there, and they're all very, very, very pleasant, lovely people and talented people.
Yeah.
But more importantly for people like you, I think, is that they're welcoming. You know, they don't pull up the ladder and say, well, good luck to you.
And even if you send out an email to them or anything, they reply and they encourage.
Oh, that's lovely to hear.
It's great.
Yeah, that's really, because, you know, the world's so full of nastiness. It's great to hear That's absolutely.
And writing is so lonely. Like it is when you're sitting there yourself, you feel like you're the only one in the world and that's doing it, you know.
There's lots of writers' centre, you know, these writers' retreats. I think they all sound lovely places to go for a week and, you know, pretend you're writing the next masterpiece.
Exactly, yeah.
Declan in Dublin says, I lost my dad at 7. He was 7 years old when his dad died in 1976 and I was also sheltered from the experience. To this day, I find it very difficult to talk about him without getting emotional. I lost my mum when I was 40 and I only remember her with a big smile. But you did say that, Janina, earlier on, like that, and I was referring to both Brian Cox and Prince Harry. And Harry's in the 90s when his mother died.
Yeah.
So I think it's relatively a new thing where we're very inclusive with the children. Everything largely is discussed and there's no fear of it, I mean, necessarily. But there's still a bit of taboo around when somebody's recently bereaved. I don't think we know how to handle them,
yes,
especially in the shop.
And I think you're afraid to make it worse.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
It's like, what if I'm opening up a can of worms here and I didn't even think of that and I'm there? You know, I think it's my dad, I think, was afraid to probably make me worse and just kind of keep it all nice and calm. There she is playing. She's grand. So there was no, it was more of an ignorance. And I mean, as I said to you, it worked well for me. I had a great childhood. It all went swimmingly.
Yeah,
it was fine. But it does, you know, you do need to deal with it at some stage, I feel, when you're a child. Because when I had my own children, then it really came back and bit me.
Go on, explain that.
Well, after my first son, I was, I feared my own mortality. I was irrational thinking about something might happen to him. I missed my mom, you know, and you feel silly. I still feel silly even saying that.
Why would you feel silly about something you feel?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You're entitled to that feeling.
I know.
So don't worry about silliness.
Yeah, you feel really like, oh, that's, you know, such a long time ago. And, you know, shouldn't you have a great life? You know, but now I realise that there's an emptiness there that you just have to kind of live with. I'll always carry the grief.
That's exactly.
But it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to define me as such. But my mum will always be someone that I will miss, and it doesn't go away.
No, it doesn't. And you will always have the photograph of you reading the book
upside down.
As a reminder to how disappointing you were to your mother from a young age. She's there in heaven
I
going,
I can read now, Mum.
No, it's too late. When I was there, she was upside down. You're
no
use to me now.
No, I think I chewed it and everything. Chewing marks on the side of that.
Well, you were very little. Listen, a lot of books are made for chewing, as you know. That's part of it. Anyway, Tony Morgan was on to say, listening to you chatting with Janine this morning, my father died when I was 5 years old. I have vivid memories, falling off the table, daddy picking me up and giving me sixpence, me with the assistance of my cousin and next door neighbour Dora, breaking every pane of glass in my father's beloved glass house. Crikey. Treasured memories all the same. Seamus Morgan, he died 55 years ago today. Nice to remember him today. Missed and loved by his 7 children. But he's down a glass house, obviously. Another says, listening to that lovely lady, that'll be Janine Edward, our guest this morning, talking about losing her mum and being afraid that something might happen to her dad, it rings a bell with me. I'm 52 years old. My dad died in 1999. He was only 55. My mum is almost 80 and has an autoimmune condition. Since COVID happened, I've been so concerned about her catching COVID. So listening to your guest chatting, I'm thinking that this is, it is quite possible that my anxiety over my mum getting sick probably stems from losing my dad. And although it's over 20 years ago, those feelings are still so raw. So thank you for helping me think about this today.
Oh,
well done. Yeah, I mean, you're helping people along the way. I'm reading a very interesting non-fiction book. It's called The Body Keeps the Score, says Teresa. It's by Bessel van der Kolk. How about that for a name?
Wow.
Anyway, how our body holds our traumas, and the science. I feel like an old woman with aches and pains since my dad died. So reflecting on the body and grief. Just a side note, Bernardo's charity does great work with grieving children. So that's two things covered there. In relation to looking like your parents, do you look like your mother or your father or both?
I actually I have the colouring of my dad, but I do look like my mum, actually. Yeah.
You got a twofer there. OK. In relation to looking like your parents, my father died, says Sarah, when I was 10. As I was growing up, everyone who knew both of us always said I was the image of him, which gave me a lovely feeling. So roll on many years at my mother's wake in 2018. Every one of my mother's and friends who hadn't seen me in a long time took a second look from across the room and gushed, I thought you were your mother. So yes, I've turned into my mother. It was lovely and gave us all a laugh. So that's what part of it is. The book you've been talking to us about is called The Thing About Feathers. And it's where can people buy it or get it?
It's on Amazon, so
The Thing About Feathers by Janine Edwards on Amazon. And we'll put a link on our webpage too.
Thank you so much.
The dream? I mean, you're a young person still. You've got a lovely family and three Well, let's say this is the first major book out. What would you like to see happen next?
I would just love people to read the book and enjoy the book, relate to it, and just to continue writing. That's all I want to do, is just continue writing, and my children's books as well.
And a publisher would you like to go with?
Yeah, like it used to be a huge deal to me. I would be thinking, oh, I need to get a publisher. But, you know, it's not the be all and end all. It's very hard for self-published authors in Ireland. Sometimes you can kind of feel like you're not part of the loop. It's hard to get in there. And like that, as I said, you're hoping someone will connect with your book on the day that you send it into them. You know, so I'm happy just for people to read the book and enjoy it.
And for
one person to say, you know, I really like that character, or it made me laugh. That's.
I think you've got a very bright future in this world ahead of you. You've got what it takes. I believe. Your chat with Janine, says Fiona, is a very honest conversation about grief and how to be in it. It's messy. We don't have words or education about one of life's inevitable chapters for us all. It's complex, and maybe because it's so final in the physical sense of connection that we're awkward around acknowledging that. So let's hope this generation continues to speak about this. It was a lovely interview. Well, let's leave it at that, Janine. It was a lovely interview. I loved your time this morning. It's really nice to meet you. You have a real job as well as the writing, don't you?
A real job, yeah. I'm a dental nurse in the HSC.
Well, they're lucky to have you. That's the truth.
Oh, thanks. They're lovely. They're really supportive.
I'm glad to hear it. And it's really nice to meet you. Best to your kids and to your husband and to your dad and the rest of your family.
Better.
If he's feeling better, two Panadol and a pat on the head from Janine this morning.
Grand.
You'll be grand. I'm going in to meet the odd fella.
you
mind
so
yourself. Congratulations. Janine Edgeworth is the author of The Thing About Feathers. Delightful guest this morning. It's 9 minutes to 10. Okay, let's go to Texas now and say a very good morning to Brian McManus. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, or it's nighttime over here.
Whatever, it's ridiculous o'clock, but we appreciate you sticking around to talk to us today because you caught our eye and we wanted to have a chat with you about what it is you do. But before we get to what you're doing to make a crust these days, tell us a bit about yourself, where you're from and how you ended up abroad.
Well, I'm from Galway, Renmore specifically. Abroad is in Texas. I moved over here about 3 years ago, just like a week before COVID started, not ideal, and moved over here to really start growing the YouTube channel from here, because a lot of the work that happens for us is based in America, and this is very centrally located in Texas, and fly back and forth from LA and New York and all that.
And before you got to making up, creating a YouTube channel, what were you doing? Give us a sense of the career path, the trajectory you were on.
Kind of started off a bit rough after graduating during the recession and all of that, and ended up moving to Malaysia for work. Ended up working in oil and gas as a design engineer, a composite design engineer for 3 years. Kind of wasn't all that passionate about that, so kind of started working on teaching myself how to animate and edit and all of that in my spare time to do what I'm ultimately doing now.
Because you've talked in the past about anxiety. Talk to me a bit about that and all the moving around career-wise and internationally.
Just after graduating in 2011, and I'm sure this is a story like nearly everyone in Ireland experienced back then, a lot of people moving away from Ireland, and I just developed an anxiety disorder and all that. Kind of the way I dealt with that and tried to overcome it was running at everything that made me anxious, because I felt like I can't control my life if I run at every single thing that made me anxious. And that kind of brought me to moving to Malaysia. And I remember the reason I actually quit my job was because I realized I was anxious about downgrading my lifestyle. And I was like, can't have that. So I just quit it and started the YouTube channel.
You left your job and then went full time with zero subscribers. That's a massive roll of the dice. What drove that?
I'd like to say it was bravery, but I think it was more desperation than anything, honestly. I just wasn't happy in the job I was working in, and I saw the path forward with what was laid out in front of me with just the oil and gas field. I knew I wasn't going to be happy long term. I was like, here, I'm young. I don't have any responsibilities right now. I can afford to take a chance here. And worst case scenario, I come back in 6 months and I'm in another job I don't like. So I think you can afford to take some chances when you're really that age, like early 20s, and just try to go for it.
But I didn't realise there was a GAA team in Malaysia.
Yeah, sure, we're all over the place at this point. I'm playing in Texas now with the Celtic Cowboys. But yeah, Orang Air in Malaysia was big part of life over there. It's always nice to have an Irish community when you land into a strange country like that.
Okay, well, let's get down to business then and talk a little bit about what you're doing now. Tell us about your YouTube channel.
Well, it's called Real Engineering. I have a second channel called Real Science as well, but my friend Stephanie is the producer on that. My main gig is Real Engineering, which I write for. I didn't like how engineering was being presented in online. I felt like couldn't be more done there to kind of encourage younger people into it. And so my mission has always been to talk about engineering in a passionate way and show people like what it actually does for the world, and just like share my passion for it. And we've just kind of gradually been growing it over the years and putting more and more into the production and all that.
So you felt that engineering, like for someone like me who doesn't understand engineering or isn't particularly going to run to the engineering section of the library, are you appealing to me or are you appealing to people who have a soft spot for engineering?
I try to make it as appealing as possible to everyone. Like, I definitely think it's a little bit heavy on the physics and math and everything. So if that's not someone's favorite thing, they may not find it all that entertaining. But I try to teach science through like interesting like machinery and things like that that are appealing to a wider audience. Like, we did a video recently on the Supermarine Spitfire, one of the like iconic planes of the Battle of Britain, and talked about how they squeezed the power out of the engine to try and make it as powerful as possible and all of that, and a lot of engineering and science that goes into that. So I think it is pretty broadly appealing to a general audience too.
Yeah, because I was watching your video clip of the wind turbines and explaining the blades and the wind and the power, and I found it fascinating. No, I really did. I'm not plumbosing it. I was kind of very engaged by it all.
Oh, the was more to it. That's a very old video.
Oh, right. Okay. Well,
my skills as an animator were still developing back then, and it was only me on the team back then. Now we have about 10 employees working with us now, helping us, so the production quality has improved a lot since those days.
Okay, well, but it was a good start. I mean, you've got YouTube channels for, you know, one of our guests recently on the Late Late Show was Jacksepticeye, who's doing for gaming, I suppose, what you're endeavouring to do for engineering.
Yeah, I mean, Sean is doing amazing work. Like, he's huge. He's one of the biggest people on the platform. Like, it's very, I think, a very different niche on YouTube, gaming versus engineering. But there's a niche for nearly everything on YouTube these days. Like, whatever you're passionate about, you can find an audience. It's one of the great things about YouTube. Like, a fairly large team at this point across the two channels. Just hired another full-time writer today. We're constantly trying to grow and do more. So, like, it's definitely the money to employ a team is there. But yeah, I mean, it depends what you're doing. There's a lot of different ways to make money on YouTube, but if you have an audience, there's a way to make money.
All right. And in terms of the videos that you've been producing, what are the most watched, the most popular? What are people drawn to?
Our most popular video right now is on a plane, the A-10 Warthog. It's kind of a bit of a meme on the internet, so that one did quite well. That's going on to, I think, has like 15 million views now.
Oh, okay.
We do a lot of aviation stuff because I studied aeronautical engineering in UL, and I'm just obsessed with planes. I just find planes really fun and interesting, and those videos tend to do quite well. Our last video, though, we're kind of moving into more documentary filmmaking type stuff instead of what we call it is a video essay, where it's just me talking and with graphics over it. But we did a documentary there with Helion, which is a nuclear fusion startup based in Seattle, and put that up over Christmas, and it's got like 4 million views already. So a fairly wide range of stuff.
But yeah, and the channel, subscribers-wise, what are you talking about?
That's a number we don't really look at anymore since it's not that important anymore. But I think it's like 3.7 million, something like that.
Yeah, in my innocence, I thought the subscriber numbers would be important to sponsors and people funding the channel.
I mean, they are to a point. The more important thing is like your average views, because you could have, like, Jacksepticeye has like 22 million I think something like that. But and I have 3 million, so like nearly 10%, or just a little bit over 10% of what he has. But we would pull similar views. But he uploads every single day, so there's a lot of different metrics there to worry about.
Yeah, of course. And what about the demographic? Can you tell from the research? Can you, as I say, drill into the numbers and find out who's more inclined to watch you?
Yeah, I was actually laughing today because I posted a thing on Twitter that kind of blew up of my demographics, asking my YouTube friends to try to beat how many people at over the age of 65 are watching their show, because I have a very large audience of people over the age of 65.
Okay.
Obviously, the engineering, I think 8.6% of our audience for the last year are over the age of 65. I think nearly 25% are over the age of 40. So definitely an older audience.
I'm so happy to hear that the computers aren't just for the youngsters. That there's content being made for oldies around the place is kind of reassuring, Brian. Yeah. I'm delighted to hear that. And what feedback are you getting in terms regarding the product that you're producing and the content you're producing? What do people like? What are they responding to?
I mean, it's hard to know exactly when, like, you just put a video up and then the views come in, and I try not to look at the comments too much, but I think people have been responding very well to our last video, just because it was kind of a sudden upgrade in our production quality, like in going and interviewing people. And it was kind of a culturally significant kind of news point with all the news with nuclear fusion coming out around the same time. So people responded to that really well. I'm personally very passionate just about climate change and the technologies we're developing to try and help solve that problem. And those videos do quite well as well. And I think people see the value in trying to encourage more people into studying that field, because it's like the biggest problem, one of the biggest problems that the world is facing right now. So,
yeah, that is amazing. And now, what's life in Texas like? I've never been there. I've wanted to go there. What's it like there?
Fantastic, really. Yeah, great music scene. I'm in Austin, Texas. So it's like a pretty nice little city, like walkable. I live like two blocks from the river down here, and there's miles of like river walks. Like people here are really nice. There's lots of like young, ambitious people, and the weather is nice for, I'd say, 9 out of 12 months. In the summer, it gets a bit too hot.
Okay, but just don't mention politics.
Oh, yeah, no. People in Austin are pretty reasonable about it, but it doesn't take long to get into the outskirts where things get a little bit, yeah, not my realm to talk about. I can't even vote, so I don't see the point in talking to people.
I agree. Stay well clear of it. Just stick with the music and the engineering. Brian, tell us, where can people go to watch your YouTube channels? What should they be searching for if they wanted to have a look at you later?
Just search Real Engineering. It should pop up right at the top.
Okay, sounds good. Real Engineering on YouTube, and you'll find out Galway's great export, Brian McManus, at work there, doing great things and making it all, making sense of it all for the likes of myself. Brian, good to talk to you. Thanks for your time this morning. We'll meet again soon, no doubt.
Yeah, thank you for your time too.
All the best. That's Brian McManus from Austin, Texas. The text number is 51551. It's just gone 9:28, and we're joined now by Mr. Todd Carmonicki. Good morning, Todd. Welcome aboard.
Good morning, Ryan.
And a pleasure to meet you.
It's a pleasure to meet you. I've been watching you since 2009, and I just realized that's quite a long time.
That is
you've
a
been
long time.
Chatting people up.
Yeah.
By the way, I want to start this by saying, because I know everybody that's listening already agrees with this, but you are really gifted at what you do. You are remarkably empathetic. And that is a quality that is missing in everybody who talks on television or the radio.
Well, because I'm Irish, I will just point out that they're laughing outside.
They're
this.
Not
they
laughing.
They're scoffing.
They're nodding
and
in
they
agreement.
Are, so they're, I've,
John
I see, I see,
and Kieran are nodding
no,
in full agreement.
No, they're putting their fingers down their throat, actually. One of them is.
Actually, they've stormed out.
They've stormed out because they think this is a fake news bulletin. Todd, you've been to Ireland so many times, but let's go into the movies and the writing and everything like that, because there's loads of places we can go here this morning. I think we'll go with the most recent, because you've just wrapped on a movie in Ireland.
11 o'clock.
Tell us all about it. What happened?
So, yes, last night on 11 p.m. on the streets of Limerick with a giant balloon light over the church at Perry Square, we rapped. I wanted to do Snow Angels, but I should have done that in Kinturk, where it snowed on our set the previous 2 days. I'm actually coming in here with the dirt of Kinturk on my pants, okay. The dried mud of County Clare. So I carry Ireland with me everywhere I go.
You do now.
After you make a movie I've been shooting this movie since November. You just run out of clothes. Yeah. So I'm just sticking with these pants till I get home.
It's a good look. It's rough and ready, but it does the job. And the film, tell us a little bit about it.
It's called God Spy. Yeah. It's a true story of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was one of the very few German heroes of World War II. And he went from being a pacifist pastor to one of the assassins of Hitler. And in the process, saved thousands of Jewish lives. He's one of the great figures of the 20th century. Wow. There have been, I think, 10 books written about him. His books have sold maybe 30, 35 million copies. And on the Wall of Martyrs outside Westminster Abbey, in between Mahatma Gandhi and MLK Jr., is Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
No way. Well, I mean, I feel ignorant now because I'm a big fan of history, but this is a name that passed me by. I feel like it's a sin of omission on my part.
It's interesting. I don't have a direct line to prove this, but I think it has to do with Germany's relationship with the war. And he deserves a lot of accolades. In fact, every other street in Berlin is Bonhoefferstrasse. It's easy to get lost if somebody's connected. Bonhoeffer Boulevard, Bonhoeffer Drive.
Yeah.
But his story would take sort of a national pride to get it out there. And I think there's a lot of shame associated with World War II for Germany, of course, for obvious reasons.
So they're reluctant to say, look, we found one, you know, the good German thing.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. I think so. But my cast is primarily German, and all of them have been deeply touched by Bonhoeffer. They're taught about Bonhoeffer. And I know in America, he's quite beloved. He's really beloved in India. Gandhi personally invited him to come study with him and spend time with him in India. And he said no, graciously, but I need to stay in Germany and help with this rising tide of hatred.
Wow.
So he was one of Hitler's nemesis. Nemesis is that like Worcester?
I was
listening earlier.
Yeah. I know the complication.
Komernicki. I can pronounce my last name, but nobody can pronounce Worcester.
Are you a Nicky, not a Nicky?
Nicky. Yeah. N-I-C-K-I.
Gotcha.
Actually, you know, we're watching about Ukraine here on the TV in the studio, and it's a Ukrainian name. I'm actually Komernicki from the village of Komernicki in Western Ukraine.
No, have you tracked that down personally in your free time or?
Yes, my grandfather was Joseph Komernicki from Komernicki. He came when he was a teenager, right before the Russian Revolution, and raised a family in Philadelphia, which is where my dad was born.
So, when you see what's happening in Ukraine, do you feel a sort of a blood connection to the story?
Of course, the tracing of the story for us is that I asked my dad, probably when I was 8 or 9, where are all our relatives from Ukraine? You know, mom's side, but there's just the people here in Philadelphia. We must have relatives. And he said that during the famine that Stalin starved everyone, and over an 18-month period, all the letters from the aunts and uncles back home just slowly trickled to a stop.
Oh, that's desperately sad. Yeah.
So that resonates very profoundly in this ongoing attack from Russia onto Ukraine. It feels so personal and also so petty. Yeah. Putin probably means petty in Russian, because such a small man doing so much damage. And studying the World War II history and seeing how Hitler was a small man surrounded by a growing chorus of sycophants, it's so important to stand up against that kind of tyranny. That's why Zelensky, of course, he's a flawed human being, but his fearlessness, like he said, I don't need a ride, I need ammunition. And he's lived that out, and the Ukrainian people have borne that out. And you see in your country, Ireland's been incredibly accepting and loving towards Ukrainian refugees, which means so much to me. And we're trying to do the same in the States. This is how we support the truth and the good, and we have to. We can't, you know, we're talking about the spring surge and how do we support Ukraine? Will Germany give tanks? Will Poland give tanks? Mm-hmm. The world has to stand up. This is a moment that is, we're not watching a movie. This is in real time with all of the world and Europe right here under threat. So we have to have acts of political courage. Sometimes that's taking in a refugee family. Sometimes it's donating. But we have to be alert.
I've about 5 million responses to what you've just said, because you've gone to so many different places. So let me just touch on a few things. One, when we did our first Late Late Show, the TV show, on the Ukraine, when the war broke out, among the audience was a young man, and he handed me a book during the commercial break, and he said, I think you need to read this. And excuse me, it was a book about the famine in Ukraine and Stalin's famine. You kind of alluded to it. And I have not, to my shame, read that just yet. But as we're talking here, I'm going to make it my mission to read it, because we had, of course, the Irish famine, which caused so many of all those Irish bars in America, probably there for because of sad reasons, actually, in their yes. genesis, if you will. So that's one thing. And then you mentioned, you know, Cade Mila Fáilte, the 100,000 welcomes. And yet there's a bit of a very nascent march of unwelcoming behaviour happening now. And we've been wondering a long time as a country, would the right and the far right get a foothold here? It hasn't yet, but there's just there's a spark of it. And that's where the good people have to come in. And that's where like the film that you were making, we need good people to do good things to stop those little guys getting out of control.
We can't abdicate.
Yeah.
It's easy to say when we look back, it's like, well, how did the German people all fall in line? Or, well, they did it by looking at the meal that was in front of them, or farming their field, or raising their children, but not paying attention to the threat, the global threat, and how it could mean, by taking care of their family only, they may put their family in danger.
Yes.
We are part of a global world. We need each other. We have to take care of each other. If we haven't gotten better at that while we're alive, all these centuries, if we're still just looking at our neighbor as other, then we're destined to fall apart.
I'm bouncing completely because you're my guest this morning, and because you're responsible so much for the movie Sully, which I watched last night with Tom Hanks. There's a good person, Sully, and Tom Hanks, but who I don't know, but Sully just had goodness in him, from what I gather. Is that what attracted you to that whole, I mean, apart from the fact that it's an extraordinary story, he lands this plane full to the brim of citizens in a city that had this very scary relationship with planes falling. As we know, we get to all of this now, and they were still in that jitters phase, I think, post 9/11. So talk to me about all of that.
The thing I felt when I met Sully, after I'd been hired to do the job, it took about 30 seconds to feel that, yes, this man landed a jet
really?
On the river.
that small amount of time.
It emanates from him.
Really?
A certainty, a confidence. He aims really high in everything that he does. So you feel that. Everything's about best practices. He is a sweetheart, but he's also an Air Force guy. So he's a bit of a badass,
okay.
But he's not going to let you know. But just you can just see how he holds his shoulders that he can take you.
So he wears it lightly.
Very lightly. And I also thought that Clint Eastwood was the perfect person to direct that movie, because there's something very similar between Clint and Sully. And I knew when the script was first sent to Clint, he said, why do I have to read it? It had been recommended to him. Everybody knows what happened. And I think the power of that movie lies in the fact that nobody knew what actually happened. And the post-crash survival for Sully was almost more difficult than the landing of the plane on the river.
The trauma, the flashbacks, the fame, all of these things.
All of those things. And also, we live in an era where we're so connected to technology that we will immediately disbelieve the human over the technological. We just say, well, humans are flawed, but AI, but this program that, you know, clearly. So even back when that happened 14 years ago, and as you saw in the film, because the computer said the engine was running, then, of course, the engine was running. Not an experienced pilot, been in the air for 30 years, knew what it was like to have both engines go, and of course, he was proven right. But they spent, I had 4 days to compress the movie to, it was 15 months of investigation, calling him at all hours, calling him with his co-pilot and without his co-pilot.
Harassing him.
Yeah, I would say. Mm. And there's no transcripts for any of these calls.
Yeah.
And they would make him go over it again and again and again. Well, there's a reason that you go after somebody, and that's usually money. So nobody liked that there was a $60 million airplane that got destroyed.
Yeah. Well,
sort of took their eye off the fact that everybody lived.
Yeah, exactly. When they started, I forgot the enormity of that story. I really did. Because there's so much going on in the world, there's so much, our senses are constantly tingling. And if you like, I'd forgotten the enormity of that plane sitting there on the Hudson River and the wing populated by, let's call them what they were, survivors.
Yeah.
Who were all heading off to play golf for the weekend, whatever, they're going to visit their mums and dads. And this pilot checking up and down the aisle, making sure there was no one left as the water came up. And you remade it beautifully, if I may say so.
Thank you.
No,
Mike,
I mean, that looked like a huge task, but my suspension of disbelief, perfect. I was there.
Well, Clint Eastwood's kind of a master. Yeah. So I went to school on that movie. Just being around him, I've been doing this for 3.5 decades now, but the first proper movie set that I was ever on was Clint's set.
Okay.
And I saw how everyone's supposed to behave. No ego, no yelling, no rushing. Still came in 4 days under schedule, $4 million under budget.
What a pro. What a pro.
Complete, and also one of the nicest people you'll ever meet.
In Clint Eastwood.
Oh, phenomenal.
So I've never met Clint Eastwood, but just as you're talking about Sully, Mr. Sullenberger. Sullenberger?
Sullenberger, yeah.
They just named the airport. They're naming it after him. The museum, the aviation museum.
I know, where the plane is. That's great.
It's remarkable. So he strikes me, seeing as you spend time with him and Clint Eastwood, as there's a very interesting phenomenon in human beings, is the introvert. I'm intrigued by introverts. And I think there's few things more interesting than a really smart introvert. Few things more boring than a boring introvert, by the way. No, you know what I mean? If you get stuck with the guy in the lift and you're going off.
On no one's bucket list.
That's on no one's
bucket list. I'd like to be stuck in a lift with a boring introvert.
I want to go swimming with boring introverts after a walk on the Great Wall of China. But you know these introverts in life who people kind of dismiss because they don't say much, but actually they're repositories of all sorts of things. They just will they'll do it in their own time, basically whatever I'm not doing.
And they're builders, they're engineers, they're doctors.
Yeah.
They're making the world work. I remember when my parents, God bless them, George and Mary Grace, miss them terribly. Yeah. But when each of them was suffering from cancer, the question was, do you want the doctor who holds your hand or do you want the doctor who gets you well?
Yeah.
And there were some people that we came across that were not pleasant. They were shy or didn't really have the bedside manner, but they were so good at their job.
Yeah.
And so my dad beat cancer 3 times. Wow. And when he died of natural causes. That's because of fierce introverts that had done the work, that cared, and they showed their care in a different way. Of course, we need extroverts too. Otherwise, you and I would not be having jobs.
We'd be kicked out. But I love that expression you just used there, fierce introverts. That says a lot. But that's your ability with words. You're a word guy. You like word play and word smithery, if you will.
You said it's getting orchid.
Yeah, I was joking.
That was fantastic.
That was an appalling dad joke. It was a
pun.
But
it's not. No, see, this is the problem. The problem is, and I have compassion for all people, but those who are not adept at wordplay have created this theory that it's puns and it's dad jokes.
Yeah.
And it's really in the French court. People had whole careers based on jeu de mots, by wordplay, being a wordsmith. This is fun. It's play. Some people can sing well. Some people run fast. And if your mind happens to click on the magic of language and turn it around like a Rubik's Cube, there's nothing wrong with that. You need to celebrate it more.
You need to be here more to back me up.
Every Friday for the next 6 weeks.
It's a new show. It's a podcast. That's what this is.
That'd be a Toddcast.
Touche. I'll get my coat. Let me ask you about Elf on the basis that it is one of my all-time favorites. And it's tied up also with, you know, the fact that I watch it with my daughters every Christmas. And it's really... It's one of those beautiful, and we love the soundtrack, and we love Louis Prima's Penny from Heaven, and we love him picking the chewing gum up off the subway rail.
Much of that chewing gum I chewed, by the way.
Did you?
Yeah, when we were shooting that scene, they just gave the producers a bunch of gum, and we were chomping about 30 pieces of gum, and then we stuck it on that. Well, we cleaned the subway railing.
Oh, I was wondering.
But he still went all in. I mean, it was our gum. We had chewed it. He didn't chew it.
Oh, but that's because he's that kind of guy, isn't he? And
fearless. Will is fearless.
Well, he seems to be happy to make a mockery of it all and himself when he runs into the coffee shop, you know, world's best coffee, and the lads behind him. And so the innocence of it is just beautiful.
Well, it's difficult. I just realized again in making this movie, you rely so much in a movie on these little moments with extras.
Yeah.
And you're not auditioning them. They show up on the day, they're cast through a different office. And it's easy to have a scene fall flat, but that greatest coffee in the world scene really leans on the extras who you've not seen in any other film, but you adore in this scene.
This is it. They're dead behind the eyes. They're looking at him saying, call the infirmary or the asylum because we've got one. How much fun was that film to make? Or was it a chore that just looks beautiful?
It was not a chore. It was a lot of fun sitting with Bob Newhart, Papa Elf. Yeah. He had all the stories. He was the extrovert. Will is the kind of comedian that's a little more quiet, but then he says two things at a dinner party and they're the best things you've heard in a year and a half. So,
you know what? I've got friends like that. There's Tommy Guns and Snipers. Right. So I'd be a bit of a Tommy Gun. Please, somebody laugh. And then another pal would come out and just... And he'd take the whole room out with laughter from one comment after an hour and a half.
That's Will.
That's Will Ferrell. Okay.
That's Will. And Jimmy Kahn, who we just lost. Sadly,
oh, yeah.
He, if we weren't rolling, was telling a long, elaborate story about Francis Ford Coppola. Yeah. So everything that came out of his mouth, people would just come around and they'd hair and makeup would be like, I think we need to do final checks. Like, no, we're good. Everyone's hair is fine. They just wanted to be around Jimmy and hearing the stories.
Wow. Just sitting at like fireside tales with...
100% with all these great actors.
And When James Caan, as you describe him in the film, he's the birth father, of course, of Buddy the Elf, and he looks at the photograph of the woman who is, of course, the mother of the birth mother of Elf, who is no longer with us, Susan Wells. Tell me about that photograph.
Well, I'm married to the mother of Buddy the Elf.
Explain that completely and clearly to us, please.
So Jane Bradbury, Ireland's own, happens to be, by the grace of God, my spouse.
And she... is the photo in the photograph.
She's the one in the photograph. She's the mom of Buddy the Elf when he comes looking for his dad, yes.
Singularly, the best boast I've ever heard since I've sat in this chair. And is that Jane? That's Jane outside?
I certainly hope she hasn't left yet. Depends on wordplay is not her favourite.
Would she care to join? Am I putting her on the spot? Would she mind? I'd love to meet her.
I'd love her to come in.
Okay, great. That'd be great. Good morning.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Have a seat over here. Sorry, I'm off microphone. No, that's okay.
You want to go here?
Yeah, this is Jane Bradbury, who's married to Todd, Comer Nicky, not Nicky, our guest this morning. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So you were born and bred where?
In Athy, County Kildare, and I lived in Ireland till I was 19, and then I migrated.
To where?
So first of all, I started modeling when my sister entered me in this Ford supermodel competition when I was 19, and I won the competition representing Ireland.
Yes.
Yes.
And
good man, Todd.
The trip was win a free trip to Orlando, Florida. So yeah. I was like, oh, that sounds lovely. So my sister took pictures and just like old camera and put it into the pharmacy to get developed. And there was loads of professional models. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to win this. And then I won. So
well, of course you
I
did.
Headed off.
Can we tell the story about your family arriving late to the event?
No.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah,
come
that's
on.
The
I
best.
Have to tell you.
You're in Ireland now. It's okay. You're among friends. Safe space.
So she's at this competition. She wins, but her family arrives late. And she's walking out and she says, oh, yeah, I won. And nobody believed her.
No, you didn't.
You did not.
Yeah, they were like, no, you didn't.
The most Irish response. You
exactly.
know, anywhere else is like, yeah, you did this. Go
yeah,
for
it. Exactly.
How would you shut up? What are you talking about? You
yeah,
won.
Exactly.
So you spent some time in Paris, didn't you? About three or four years in Paris,
yes.
Which from what I understand was lovely, but then got really boring.
Yeah.
And,
I wasn't working in Paris and you'd spend the day, this was before the internet, you'd spend like 9 hours walking around all of Paris, tracing upstairs, showing your portfolio. They go, no, thank you. And, you know, got disheartening after a while. I had been to French Vogue about like... a million times. They're like, you're here again.
Todd, we can relate to that.
Yeah.
We've been, myself and Todd. Bonjour.
Yeah, yeah.
Encore une fois.
Exactly. So I finally did end up working for French Vogue after. But I got a chance to go to New York and I was like, yes. And then, you know, I was just totally blown away by New York because, you know, Monday to Sunday, you're out every night.
Yeah.
Everyone spoke English. I started to work straight away And then I fell in love with New York for about 20 years.
I'm sure she was going to say Todd there, but actually she said New York first.
That's okay. That's okay.
Because when you met at an audition, you didn't fall in love at all. I mean, that's what I think is real. What I love about your story is that it was just, it was all obviously good, but you must have known, come on, Todd, there must be something somewhere in you that said, she's just not like anyone else.
No, the best way to put it, this describes Jane perfectly. So we had become friends and I thought we were out on a date. And
you thought.
Yeah, I thought.
Exactly. Well, yeah. You thought.
I thought. I was misinformed.
By himself.
I was going to say, sorry, Todd.
But the genius of who Jane is, and I think this is something quite Irish too, is that she's so fully who she is all the time. Mm. She is without guile. You get Jane, that she's not pulling a trick. She's not shaping things. She's not pitching you something. She's just Jane. So when I asked her if I could kiss her on that given night, she roared laughing. She leaned all the way back on her bar stool.
How are you guys still together?
And this is 1998. And she just laughed so hard with that great, wonderful, horsey laugh. And then she said, I don't want to kiss you. We're friends. And with any other person, of course, I would have been the squash grape at the bottom of the boot. But with Jane, because who Jane is, we wound up talking for another hour. And it actually was the bedrock of a great friendship. And it's always the woman's decision. So months down the road, when she had come to the thought that maybe it could be her and I.
We called that her senses.
Yeah.
Go on.
No,
I'm joking.
And it was, and you know, she knocked on my door.
Wow.
And so luckily enough, I said yes.
How old are your children?
13 and 10.
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah.
So, you guys, I love you guys. You're great company. I had a feeling, because when I heard about your movie, I said, okay, I'd love to meet these guys. And then we were talking about maybe going down to Limerick to make it happen.
Oh, yeah.
And then we heard that you were happy to come to see us here in Dublin. So it's worked out. But you've not only matched my expectations, you've exceeded them. We need to hang out sometime.
Oh, thank you.
Right after the show.
I wish. If I wasn't working tonight, sorry to go. We could just keep
go
going.
For some
pints. Go on. Yeah.
The crew was amazing in Ireland because we shot half of it in Belgium and then the other, you know, quarter in Ireland. And the troops were just incredible.
And did you say, was it your suggestion to Todd to film in Ireland?
Yes.
Well done, Jane.
I know.
Good on
and
you.
And then the Limerick County Council got us down and was selling everything. They were like, come to Limerick. And
well, you know, I get to meet some great actors on the TV show that I do regularly. And they always say what you just said about the Irish crews at every level. You mentioned hair and makeup earlier on, but also cameras and every bit of it. They said they're a pleasure to work with. They don't mess around.
No messing.
And there's humour on set as well, which is great. Okay, loads of texts, but just very quickly, delighted to hear that Todd and Jane are with you. My brother and I had a bar in the London Terrace building in Chelsea, New York. Todd and Jane used to come and see us, and they were without doubt two of the nicest people we would meet every week. I've now moved home and I live close to the Bradbury's Cafe, Jane's family in Kildare.
It's the Hines brothers.
This is the Hines brothers. They just said, welcome to Ireland, Todd. This is how it works.
Well, listen, I got full body chills because here's what happened. When I auditioned Jane, it was her first movie audition in her life. And I wasn't quite sure if she was going to have the experience I needed for that role. So we had our first ever one-on-one meeting was at Hines Brothers.
And
crazy?
So we go full circle in which to end our conversation this morning. So Todd Comer-Nicky, you are responsible for this film that we're all going to go and see. You'll have to have a good old premiere here so we can go and
100%.
God Spy and we can have the crack there for
sure. I promised I'd give some shout outs here to my Irish crew.
Yeah. Please do.
Our camera operators were amazing. Fionn Comerford and Des Whelan. Owen, the focus puller. Tom McInerney on makeup. I loved making a movie here. We laughed.
Good.
We worked through the muck and the cold. We were on the top of planet Earth getting blown sideways. And nobody blanched. The hardest working group I've ever come across.
Owen, the focus puller, sounds like Thomas the Tank Engine.
That's the new show. We can do that. Following the Ryan Turbidity show, it's Owen the focus puller.
Owen the focus puller is going to work again. Okay, Jane and Todd, thank you for being here. And
yes, thank you
let's
for
do it again
us.
Sometime. We'll catch up and
That'd
see how we're going.
Brilliant.
Look forward to it.